Okay. I'd like to talk to you today about some newer projects I've been working on. I don't have anything published on this yet. That's why I like talking about it, because I still have time to adjust my thinking about it with your all's opinions on this stuff. It dates back to a couple of years ago when I was working on a cluster called SIGOBI-2, widely known cluster. It's been known for decades. And there was this paper by a couple of Spaniards that said that they were identifying new stars that might be part of SIGOBI-2. And I had some time on a telescope, so I went ahead and looked at these stars and sort of found that there were a whole lot of old stars that had been missed from, for instance, Phil Massey had missed in his surveys from the early 90s. And also there was infrared data that suggested that there was some very massive, a lot more mass there than had previously been recognized. At this time, there was another cluster called Westland 1, which I don't know if you know the cluster, but it's going to be highlighted a bit in this talk, too, that was just starting to be recognized as being a very massive cluster, too. And it got me thinking about how really little we know about the high-mass clusters, or even the high-mass stars, yes, but the clusters in our galaxy, because we can't see very far. Most of the people working in high-mass stars, not necessarily formation so much, but in high-mass stars, the community that I more or less was birthed from, they tend to work in the LMC because there the distances are all the same. They can, you know, see things very clearly. They don't have the distance problems and extinctions. But not many people are really working in the galaxy to answer questions about high-mass stars other than formation. So I began thinking about, you know, what it is that what do we really know about our galaxy, what we don't know? What are the limitations of what we've measured so far? I like this picture a lot because it's kind of like what I wish I could see about our galaxy. We'll never have a picture like this of our own galaxy. We're just always going to be stuck in the middle of it and not be able to see really where the spiral arms are. And I think about, you know, that whoever's astronomers in this galaxy are looking at us and they have a gorgeous view, just like we have of their galaxy, of our galaxy. You know, there's some graduate students studying our systems and stuff somewhere, right? But we can't see our own. You know, it's kind of an interesting point.
If you wait a million years,
just wave. Well, if they could just send us their papers, then you know, that would help too. This work is also done with my graduate student Bogdan Popescu. Okay, so high mass clusters. I think one of the more important things, I mean, many important things came from HST, but I remember in the beginning some of the bigger hypes that was going on with the HST measurements was the discovery of very massive proto-globular cluster-like mass objects that were in the process of forming that were very young. Okay, and this is a picture of, you know, HST with its great sensitivity, ultraviolet, as well as the spatial resolution, was able to resolve individual points that came out to be these masses of 10 to the 6, even 10 to the 7, of star clusters forming today. Okay, so that was very important. There was some predictions that this might be seen by some people, but this was certainly unlike any kind of star formation going on in the galaxy, right, at least today. Surely we formed very massive clusters 13 billion years ago, but the assumption was that that was a special kind of formation, and that doesn't happen anymore, right? But this showed that at least in these kind of systems, very massive clusters could still form in today's epoch, right? And that was sort of the important point. But that's really kind of only half the picture. Let me first talk about these clusters a bit more. So this is a well-known study of the antenna galaxies done by Zhang and Fall, Michael Fall. And if you look at the mass function, this is sort of, it's implied mass from the luminosity, but the number versus the mass, you get more or less a power law, particularly with the youngest clusters. As you get a little older, you start to lose the lower mass clusters, possibly due to them falling apart or something and being disrupted. And then here's the system of globular clusters. And what's interesting, though, is they found that the clusters followed a nice slope of -2 with mass, the power law. Okay, so this has been known now for almost 10 years, and this describes a range of masses of clusters that are much beyond anything that we looked at really in our own galaxy that are young, 10 to the 4 up to 10 to the 6. And even I think they did have some that were even possibly 10 to the 7. But here's the question. and this is where I run into a little bit of difficulty. It has been thought, at least when I first started talking about this, that that was very unique kind of formation scenario that could create such massive clusters. A merger created, you know, unusual sort of shocks of some sort that you would never see that kind of formation occurring in a quiescent galaxy, right? And actually, this is a galaxy called NGC 628. It's a nearby spiral, SC, late-type spiral. It's not that far away, which is why you can see it so well. This is another HST picture, I think. Well, but maybe it isn't. I'm not sure. But you can see all the spiral arms and all the different clusters in there. And the resolution is good enough with this being nearby that you can actually break down, just like Michael Fall did with the antenna galaxy. You can look and see the masses of all the clusters that are forming today in just a typical spiral. And this really wasn't possible to do without HST. And Soren Larsen did this for a number of galaxies within, you know, a few, I don't know, maybe 5 megaparsecs, where you could really see well the individual stuff. And now while we don't have masses here, I've tried to put a little thing. 30 Doradus, which is about 10 to the 4 or so, is right around here. And they found about 4 or 5 examples of 30 Doradus-like young clusters within NGC 628. And again, almost all of them had power laws within an error of a few of being -2, just like what was found in the antennae galaxy. Okay? So the point is, though, is that the amount of star formation going on here, though, is pretty low. If you had a lot more star formation and just were making simply more clusters on average, as this would go up, the prediction is that you would be able to produce more massive clusters. You see precisely what you would think you would see based on the statistics of what a power law would give you for the number of clusters that you're forming. Okay? So isolated galaxies will show massive young clusters. They don't need to be ramming into each other. The question is just how much star formation you have. It's very similar to you don't get a high mass star unless you have a significant amount of mass going into star formation to have statistically have a massive star form, right? It's just a power law.
Is it surprising that it's the same power law in the sense wouldn't you be incomplete at the low luminosity end?
Yeah, this end is where you get incomplete. Yeah, that's true.
So it's sort of surprising that you still get the same power law.
Yeah, well, you know, power laws are really forgiving, yeah, right? That's why we like them so much. Most things can fit a power law pretty easily. But there's many more galaxies he's done.
So how is this different, though, than what Kennicott found even long before that? Because, you know, he looked at...
Sort of power law?
Yeah, you know, he had luminosity function he got for clusters, you know, just using H-alpha, and this is for the ground-based observations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he found that typically they are like -2 also.
Yeah, well, then that fits together, I guess, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of things that are pointing towards this.
Right. So when John Williams and I looked at that, though, we concluded that in some cases, like you say, it looks like the power law just runs down to zero. But in other cases, it looked like they got to a maximum and then it suddenly dropped.
That is in here, too, about whether or not there is a cutoff, like there is with the high-mass stars, that there's a cutoff. You cannot make a 2,000-star mass star, no matter how big a molecular cloud you make.
Yeah. On the clusters.
Yeah, but this is on the cluster side, right, yeah. A mass cutoff. No, that's what we have to look at now. Yeah.
So what's the ratio of the star formation rate between the antennae and this galaxy?
About a factor of 1,000.
Oh, it is a factor of 1,000. So you could go down with a -2. You could probably go up to 10^5 solar masses easily.
Yeah. The antenna is about 100 times the Milky Way, and this is almost a tenth the Milky Way. It looks impressive, right? This looks very impressive. There's so much star formation going on, but it's a very small galaxy. So you have to look at the total amount in the whole galaxy, right? Again, it's a statistical thing.
M31
star formation is much below the Milky Way as well.
What's the mass of the galaxy?
Oh, I don't know. It's bigger than LMC, but not. I mean, it's definitely big. It's like an M33 kind of galaxy.
It's a dwarf.
Yeah.
It's a local.
It's a local group guy. Yeah, it's like M33, Triangulum. They're beautiful big spirals. They look like it, but they're actually very small in total mass.
So how massive is 30
Doradus? Well, you can see a graph where it has a wrong number. I think it's on the order of 10^4. Okay, and it kind of depends a little bit if you call it 30 Doronis, which includes sort of the star formation going around the circle, or R136, which is just the central cluster. There's maybe a factor of 5 there, wiggle, but not more than that. Maybe a factor of 3, you know. But okay. Okay, so here's the question. Does such a power law apply to the Milky Way clusters? Well, this is really hard to do, right, because we don't really have complete surveys of the galaxy. For historical perspective, let me just talk about a paper that was done quite some time ago, more than 20 years ago, by Vandenberg, where he took at that time the survey of all the open clusters that were known at the time. Okay, and at that time, the most massive cluster known well was H and Chi Persei, which is a few times 10 to the 3. It's not very, and certainly not a superstar cluster in anybody's mind. The survey is only really complete, and not even really complete, beyond 1 kiloparsec, but that's basically the range in which it's sampling. It's a very small area that's sampling. But what they found, LaFontaine as well, was they did fit a power law of -2 yet again, for what they could see, at least locally, right? And then talking with Ralph yesterday, I found an interesting paper that he'd written talking about that if you look at the globular clusters, and if you plot them in the right way, you actually find they also follow a -2 power law. Okay, so -2 is coming up everywhere, right? So it shouldn't be too hard to kind of imagine where I'm kind of going with this. Okay, so the problem, of course, is that, you know, this was our galaxy.
Oh, we look at a picture.
No. That if this were our galaxy, this is kind of the range that we're looking at, because recall we're really pretty far out from all the action. And the star formation rate is nearly a factor of 10, you know, halfway into the galaxy, higher than it is here. So we just don't really have much going on right here. So, okay. Sidney Vandenberg is a very bright guy. He knew he wasn't seeing the whole galaxy. And so in this paper of 1984, what he did was he integrated up and said, okay, the whole disk is there. If I just assume that this is the same power law applies for the whole galaxy, I would get 100 clusters with an MV of about -11, which is about 10 to the 4. And I'd even get several clusters with masses of as much as 10 to the 5. Okay? And that was really difficult to comprehend for him at the time. And so this is directly from his paper. It is hard to believe the galaxy contains so many undiscovered superluminous open clusters. This suggests that the luminosity function of galactic clusters starts to fall below the extrapolation level in this range where we just don't see massive clusters. And that is pretty much what people thought, is that the Milky was incapable of making high mass clusters because we don't see them.
But I mean, if you believe that there is dust, there is not.
Right. You're a much nicer crowd than I've talked to before about this. You don't have preconceived ideas.
They don't have an infrared camera.
Yeah, and what I'm going to tell you, though, is too, is the infrared has definitely helped, but it also has some caveats to it, too. It hasn't, you know, revealed everything to us, right? Okay. This is another paper I really like. What I did in order to kind of get a grasp of this is I kind of stepped outside of my field a little bit and read a whole bunch of papers about superstar clusters and other galaxies and all this stuff. This one I really liked. This is a paper that found a very tight correlation. Again, it's a log-log space, so things always look good in log-log space, which maps the star formation rate in solar masses per year versus the most massive cluster that can be seen to form in that galaxy. So each of these stars represent an entire galaxy, and there's tens of them here. And our galaxy is not on this chart. Okay, I put this on here myself. And I put it on based on our star formation rate is one of the global things that we do actually know pretty well. It's about a solar mass per year. We're not going to be off by more than a few on that. Okay, so we put the Milky Way on there, and then I stop it sort of where all these little lines seem to be suggesting, and lo and behold, you get that a little more than 10 to the 5, maybe. On the order of 10 to the 5 should be the most massive cluster formed in the Milky Way. This correlation, I believe, is a direct response to the fact you have a power law with star formation, and a power law for the formation, and it just corresponds with the star formation rate. As you increase the number of clusters you make, you can make a bigger cluster, have more chance of making a bigger cluster.
So the lines are based on some power law? Or?
The lines, I think, are fits. The dark line is a fit to the data. These I think, are theoretical ideas about other things.
Is it consistent with this minus 2?
Oh, this is not going to have a minus 2, and I don't think. I don't know what this line is.
Is getting n proportional under the minus
2. I don't know. That's a good point. Well, because the minus 2 is a fit of not just the most massive, it's a fit of all the clusters in the mass function, right? So I don't know. I mean, what you could do is take a normalization and say, is this consistent with, that as you increase the normalization, which is the star formation rate, that you move out and out and out and further until you get a higher minus. Yeah, yeah. I've not done that calculation, but this basically looks like it's pretty correlated to that.
This correlation, does that mean that, I mean, it's the most massive clouds are producing most of the stars.
And that's true.
Massive clouds have the most massive young clusters. So it's implying the cluster mass and star forming mass scale together.
It does seem to, doesn't it? Yeah, because it looks as though you make really high massive clusters and it's the same star formation rate. So this is this is not quite the antennae, but antennae would be up here. It's 100 times. And it's forming at the same efficiency. Whatever the efficiency is, it's the same. It's remarkable.
But most of the star forming mass, I think that's the way the IMF and the cloud functions go. It's dominated by what the GMCs, the really big clouds, do. The small clouds don't matter.
But then
it's different than the IMF.
Right. But wouldn't that then say that we actually don't know the star formation rate of the Milky Way?
We get that from, I think, integrated mid-infrared and stuff like that. That is
Kobe observations.
Yeah, and magnesium, this kind of. That's pretty well known. And the nice thing about that is that the methods used to determine it for our galaxy are the same methods used for determining the other galaxy. That's one thing we can really map between galaxies, between our galaxy and other galaxies. The hardest thing between the extragalactic and the galactic community is that we use completely different methods for arriving at different answers, the same answer, right? And that makes a discontinuity when you try to compare things. So
the application here is if you have clusters of 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 solar masses, that in fact an entire GMC has been converted to a strong thunder.
Well, I don't know if it has to, because you're saying because you don't believe a GMC can ever afford that's 10 to the 7. Is that why?
The upper limit on masses of GMCs is on the order of 10 to the 6.
Well, it's actually closer to 10 to the 7.
The point is that they're going to be very short-lived. And we don't need very many of them, right? The rarity of these things make them still possible, statistically.
Yes.
But 10 to the 6 is more common, and that would make maybe the 10 to the 4 to the 10 to the 5 cluster. Probably not even 10 to the 5. I think it's, 1% efficiency? Is that pretty much? So you get 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 cluster would make 10 to the 4, right,
need
of stars.
More mass generally.
Yeah.
Produce those stars, then actually it makes it stars.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the 10 to the 7th would say that there is a pretty hard limit somewhere up there.
When I talked about this at another conference, Nick Scovel was the one that just said, no, you'll never form clusters of this mass because you could never form a molecular cloud that big. And I just wasn't sure that statement was so could be confidently made like that. I'm just not so sure.
About 10 to the 7th.
Yeah.
So that's unique.
Yeah, but
you only need one to have the highest.
Yeah, these are the 10 to the 5 is the unique guy. It's the only one in the galaxy, right? It's just one.
I can tell you, we have detected a cluster right in the disk of the galaxy in the order of about 10 to the 6, a cluster now, about 10 to the 6 or so solar masses.
Is it a young cluster or is it an old cluster?
Well, that's still debatable.
What
the stellar, what the age is.
Well, I think with Spitzer, which I'm going to talk about, and Tumi, we're starting to see these things. So, 10 years ago, these things would never have been seen.
How many do you need to make?
Well, it predicts that the most mass is going to be about 10 to the 5. So, you're going to have maybe one in the galaxy, one or two, on the order of a few. Yeah, that's it. That's all you're going to form, statistically.
Well, if I go back to your comment, though, Ed, how can you determine the mass if you don't know the age of the cluster?
Well, I mean, as I say, this is based on some assumptions, of course, but it looks for all the world like a globular cluster, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, for your definition of young, what?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that because they were looking with UV HST, they were really looking at stuff that was on the order of tens of millions of years old. I think once, and I mean, the work on the antennae showed that these clusters really didn't last very long. I mean, that's really a big thing. A big question, which is, I'm not even going to go there, is but how long these clusters survive? Probably not very. The antenna ones seem to be dying. I mean, I think that Fall said the infant, it was like within 90% were gone in 10 million years. Right? They're just dissociated.
But it's all the low mass, not the high mass.
I think, it might have been more highly affected to that low mass, but there's also selection effects that you really are, it's a nightmare to try and sort out. So.
But in that plot, they're all young.
Yeah, these are all pretty young.
That's important.
Yeah, they're young. They're tens of millions. They're not hundreds of millions of years old.
And so you do expect a lot of scatter because if you're looking for the youngest,
biggest, it's more stochastic.
And youngest.
Yeah. That's why it's a little fuzzy. Here's where they've got 30 Doronas totally in the wrong spot. I don't know if anybody knows better than me, but I don't really believe 3 Doronas is 3 times 10 to the 5. But, you know, it's down here. It's around 10 to the 4. And look, it falls right into the path with everybody else. So the one discrepant point even on this graph is clearly wrong.
Oh, we've got bigger points. So there's really something for sigma. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It's almost like they're within their sigmas, pretty almost too much.
Well, why doesn't 30 Doronas have... I thought that if you looked at the light, it just keeps on going. So that, as you point out, you can have R136, but no matter how far out you go, there's a sort of a gradual fall off in the light, and you have massive stars. So even half a kiloparsec still fits into this overall pattern.
Yeah, and I think that would be because it's like look at W49 in our galaxy. There's a couple of clumps, but the whole region is 10 to the 7 in mass of the Milky Way cloud, but it's probably not going to make a 10 to the 6 single cluster. It's going to make... bunch of 10 to the 4s and 5s, maybe.
Well, I think that's the problem that I'm having.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, W49 breaks up into many, many small clusters.
Right.
Over a size of about
3 parsecs. Yeah, it's very large.
But maybe, I mean, I'm not sure if there's any cluster in the galaxy.
Well, they're starting to come out now, aren't they? These massive clusters.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
But it's hard to understand how you can keep this large volume of gas.
Mm-hmm. Well, from being sheared, and exactly.
In other galaxies, you may not be able to tell.
Well, I know that's the point I was making.
Can't tell. Right. Yeah.
What are those stars on the low end that go...
I'm sorry, I don't actually know. I don't remember what those had to do with. Sorry. Okay, so... what I think is interesting, though, is that I think there's some sort of fundamental physics here going on. The minus 2 and this relationship, I think, would be predicted that there'd be a relationship between what is basically the normalization, which is the star formation rate, and if it's statistical power law, then you just get a direct correlation with the most massive star you would statistically see. And the numbers come out pretty close. I mean, again, we have... lots of factors of 10 here we can mess with, but nonetheless, it's a pretty good correlation. Okay, so the question becomes now we got to try and prove ourselves. How do you find these clusters? And I do believe that they are starting to surface in the various surveys, as Ed was just pointing out. I will also show some other examples of objects which appear to be very, very massive. Okay. And much more massive than anybody ever thought, and also much more massive than any other massive young clusters in the entire local group. More massive than anything in M33, more massive than anything in M31. But that's predicted because our galaxy has the highest star formation rate of any of these galaxies anyways. Okay, so starting, you know, as soon as 2MASS was more or less out and available, people started doing surveys using 2MASS, JH, and K. One limitation is that the J is just not... very extinction-free. K is pretty good, and H is not bad, but J just doesn't get you very far. And so if you're needing to use a three-color diagram to try and separate out your clusters and things like that, you're limited to very nearby. As soon as extinction gets to be above about 10 or 15, 2MASS really starts to drop out for you. It's not very deep, and also the J is not so good. So we're actually going to be using GLIMPS, I think, which is a little deeper. It has sort of similar resolution, but it's just deeper, and it also goes to longer wavelengths. I actually wonder if probably the most efficient way to find clusters, young clusters, is perhaps a combination of H, K, K and 3, or maybe K, 3, and 4.5. I have not had a chance to play with that. I'm almost certain you guys have.
We have.
Yeah, that's one of those.
It's a good band to use, K band. And
exactly, with the other two, right. Because you can't, this one already start losing it. You go too long, and then you start seeing all the emission stuff. And you immediately need to stay in the area of the photospheres. And this is where they still dominate, the flux here.
So K band, how far can you see in the galactic plane?
Well, you can see the galactic center in the K, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, K...
There's still a lot of extinction.
It's three magnitudes, right? It's a factor of 10 down from the V. So three magnitudes, you can work with that.
Yeah,
I think...
It's in certain areas. There are areas
But they tend to be special, pencil beam areas where the AV is 50 or 100, and then your K is dead, right? And even these guys are mostly dead, too. I believe the extinction does continue to drop, but not as quickly as you might guess. It drops very quickly between J, H, and K through K. From J to K, it's a big difference, a great boon in how far you can see. But you don't gain anywhere near that level of boon again by going to these slightly longer wavelengths. You achieve most of that. And then all of a sudden you hit basically between a rock and a hard place. You want to go as red as possible to get through the dust, but then you hit the dust. All right, so you really have to work in that little region there. And that's basically going to be the optimal spot. And I think it'll work for AVs 30, up to 30. Even maybe 40 or 50, if you go deep enough. And if you get follow-up imaging. Okay, so Ed's talked about...
You get quite a bit of scattering, though. If you want to get precise information on the stars, even at K and even more at 3, you start to get a lot of dust, a lot of scattering. If you want to go very deep, you've seen this...
Yeah, well, what the source of confusion is when you go deep in K and these bands... You're still mostly above most of the dust, except for dust that's very close to stars, which is hot enough, right? But that's not spatially a problem, right? The problem is the K giants. There are so many giants. You see every single bloody one. And they just your whole field is full of these giant stars, right? And they can be very, very bright. And there's so many of them in the galaxy. And so as you go deeper and deeper, that number of K giants you see just keeps going up and up. So that's... as far as point sources go, that's really a source of confusion in trying to find, which are the stars that are part of a cluster and which is just a bunch of K giants. And in fact, these surveys from Bica and Deutera, which started here, and also this more recent one, also based on TUMAS, more than half of the clusters that have been identified by these surveys turn out not to be clusters. They turn out to be holes in extinction where K giants are coming through as a high flux of point sources, and they're not spatially associated. So that's your main source. And so the only way to know is you got to go back and actually take more images of these things, deeper images, higher spatial resolution, maybe pull in the J if you can get it, because the JHK helps you separate out K giants from the massive stars, because there's some water bands in there that separate them.
But what do you mean by massive stars?
I do mean O stars.
O stars?
Yes. Yeah.
But they are older. They are over
the O stars are 20 solar mass.
You said they were 10 to the 7 years old?
Well, there won't be any O stars then. Yeah. The massive stars, well, they're gone. So you'll see them as, I'll show you, you're going to see them as red supergiants. You'll see that nothing but red supergiants then. So this is a cluster which we really, really wanted to get spectra of, because we really what we've done is we've gone through. This is with Emily Mercer at BU, who's part of the Spitzer team, and she went through with the GLIMPSS survey and identified about 100 clusters. And these are all clusters that had not been previously identified with TUMAS, and she's on average seen much further into the galaxy too. I think some back of the envelopes told her she was maybe seeing three kiloparsecs, where most of TUMAS is around 1 to 2. And the point is that what you do to confirm what this cluster is about is it's quite easy. You basically go back and get better. This is a 4-micron image actually from Spitzer. But she's actually gone through and done a deeper, higher spatial resolution in J, H, and K. And then here you have... See, here's your source of K giants. I mean, there's huge scatters all over here, which has to do with probably blended stars and stuff. But this is all the K giants. They go along here. O star is actually, unread O star starts here, and it runs along this path. And so this is where blue stars would be that were heavily reddened. Okay, so there's, what we're looking for is blue things that are just really, really red, reddened. And they do look different than intrinsically red things that are very, very reddened. Okay? And so this is a, this is actually kind of one of those, I mean, it's got to be a bunch of B supergiants or something, because they all have about the same extinction. They tend to be over here. They're not over here with the K giants. And these, all the red stars are ones that are within a circle, a small circle based on those bright objects there. Just small concentration of stars. Okay? There's still a bunch of junky stars, which are just the ones between. But the point is, what you do is you go to the telescope. These are not so bad. They're magnitude of maybe 10 or 11 or 12 in the K. And you can get actually reasonable spectra with, even with a 4-meter class, you want to do a really good job. You want to go an 8-meter. But just to confirm that they are hot stars and get a first handle on the distance and the temperature and all the stuff you can do once you've got the spectra of stars. And this is actually the only thing I've shown you now that I actually do. I don't do any other stuff. This is what I do. I do spectroscopy of hot stars. Okay, that's what my thing is. And I have collaborators in Munich, mostly Joachim Pools. And we've been working for the last couple of years with him to develop very robust atmospheric models that can use the near-infrared lines alone. Because if we're going to do any kind of analysis on these stars, we cannot say, well, let's just try and get an optical spectrum. You can't. You're going to have to work something out where you can only use the infrared. And it's been these spectra of exceptional quality, they're used to calibrate the atmospheric models. We don't need single noise of 300 to get the temperature of a star. I mean, we can get, with a single noise of 300, we can test wind models in the atmospheres. We don't need to do that. We just need to get temperature of a star. And so a single noise of 100 with moderate resolution of 1,000, we can get temperature very effectively, because there's a pair of helium lines, helium-2, helium-1. Where's the helium-1 line? Well, there's a helium-1 line here, which is not being modeled here. There's a helium-1 line at 2.112 in the K-band. There's a helium-1 line at 1.7, a very strong one in the H-band. So if you get a helium-1, helium-2, just between those, you get a very good handle on the temperature. So that's what we do. Now, so as Ed has suggested, we're actually starting to see though some of these clusters. So I don't have to be quite so strong about, you know, explaining why we should see them, because they really are starting to show up now. And this is because the spits are partly. But recall when I started the talk, I was saying I did this little study on SIGO B2. And it's a cluster that had been around and known for decades. And you know, one of the hot star community's finest, Bill Massey, did a full study of that cluster. How could he have missed a signal on its mass? You know? The point is that extinction was part of it. It turns out that the area that he was seeing was more or less a hole in the extinction. It's this wonderful map that somebody had done. It's Noddle Center. He had showed that the distribution of stars that Massey found was right in a hole where the extinction of AV dropped to 4 or 5, where around it was more than 10. And once extinction gets to be 10, that's it. You're not seeing anything in the optical. And so even though Massey's stars were made an oval on the sky, the cluster itself is a perfect circle. Okay? So it's very interesting, right, that the extinction was just not fully appreciated. Okay? The same is true for this cluster, which is now, I mean, until you tell us that it's a young cluster, this is the most massive young cluster known, we think, in the local group. It's very hard to get a mass yet. But many people have suggested it's on the order of 10 to the 5. The interesting thing about this cluster is this cluster was discovered in 1961. 1961. So it's been known for all these times, and nobody had any idea it had the enormous mass that it had. When you look at it, first of all, the extinction's about just a little over 10. So you don't really see it very well in UBV. It was discovered by Wesselin in these the early eye plates that they had, maybe around 8,000 angstroms or something. And all he saw in that eye plate, which is why nobody cared, was about a dozen stars. A dozen stars that seemed to be very reddened. And that's it.
But in 2-mass, there must be a few more.
Oh, my gosh. If you put this in 2-mass, it's a monster. It's enormous.
So but two mass should have already told you that it was big.
Oh, 2-mass tells you that it's a big cluster, yeah. But not until 2-mass. And nobody had ever imaged it, I don't think, before 2-mass happened to go past it, right? And then it shows up.
So how far in radius do you have to go in that image to pick up most of the mass, say, 10 to the 5 or so?
Oh, I think it's actually mostly contained in here.
Oh, I see.
I do think that this one and these guys, I don't remember about these ones, to be honest, but I think these guys are part of it. But it's pretty contained in here. It's a little bit blotchy though. But it's just that nobody really realized how massive it was, because all they saw was a dozen stars, and it just wasn't of interest enough to anybody to ever follow up on it. Okay, and it was Simon Clark. Well, I admit, as a graduate student like 10 years ago, he was doing some work on radio measurements of winds and stuff, and somehow he looked here and found lots of radio emission from what would have been winds from very massive stars and maybe in binaries. And he's like, well, there's just giants here. They aren't giants, they're super giants, and there turns out to be tens of Wolf-Rayet stars in this cluster. Okay, and that's where the radios come from, those winds from the Wolf-Rayet and the other stars, and probably hundreds of B supergiants. I took a spectrum of 100 stars in this cluster, and I hit two Wolf-Rayet, and not just random, you know? You know, you just kind of go boom, 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 and you get home and you reduce them all. And every single one except maybe four were hot stars. I hit two or three Wolf-Rayet stars, one LBV. I avoided the known red supergiants because they would just blast the whole slit because they were super bright. But everything else was B supergiants. Just B supergiants coming out of your ears. And that's what you would predict for a cluster of this mass. It's completely consistent with it being 10 to the 5. Okay. Okay. Okay, so now I think the extragalactic people are starting to recognize that there are massive clusters in our galaxy. Okay, this was a couple years ago where I went to a conference on massive superstar clusters. And, of course, everybody was extragalactic, right? I was the only galactic astronomer there. And so when I got up and said something about the superstar clusters in the Milky Way, that's when this huge debate took place where everybody said, no, it's not going to ever happen. You're never going to see high mass clusters in our galaxy. We can't make molecular clouds 10 to the 7, blah, 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 all these arguments. Okay? So now, this is now a massive star, an extragalactic group. Now, this turn, it's interesting. I think they've now completely accepted that Westland 1 is 10 to the 5. That's WD1. And they're now using that as a way to maybe test for a high mass cutoff for clusters, as you brought up before. And this is an interesting thing. Right? It's interesting to know whether or not there's some physical limit to how massive a star you can make. Is there some physical limit by how massive a cluster you can make? And this is what they say, using the Milky Way, assuming the number density of clusters is constant out to Westland 1, 4.5 kiloparsecs, they now suddenly expect to have a cluster of 10 to the 6. And I haven't figured out, when I got so rambasted, you know, like 4 years ago over suggesting there be any, now they're expecting them. I haven't figured that one out. And that's 10 times more massive object the fact that it could not have been found, it seems reasonable, they think. And so they think that actually 10 to the 5 is the mass cutoff, that the Milky Way is unable to make clusters more than 10 to the 5, based on all the great statistics we have on the massive clusters in our galaxy.
In your plot, it was 10 to the 5, though. So in your plot, it would have been...
I would never have guessed 10 to the 6 anyway. I mean, I'm not saying it was completely ruled out, but it wasn't. It's not expected, that's for sure, right? I think it's a weak argument, right? Okay.
Well, they're just saying that you've only sampled 10% of the area of the galaxy, and if it goes, the number above some mass goes is 1 over m, so if you have 10 times the area, you get, in principle, you get 10 times
the size. Within 10, within 4.5.
So it's a little bit bigger than 10%.
There's a little bit more than 10%.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean,
but again, they're...
That there should be a 10 to the 6 solar mass cluster.
I know, because they've seen 10% of the area, okay. And then... therefore, the number goes above some mass goes as 1 over the
mass. No, but Chris, this is small number statistic. You cannot say that. Maybe you found the only one, because if there is only one and you found the only one, you cannot multiply by 10 because you sampled 1/10.
No, they have this smooth. This you showed is the end of a smooth distribution. If you just continue the distribution, then the expected number would be.
What I would like to see, I think, is if
you better find a turnover somewhere, otherwise you don't know what it is.
No, but as I said, what we concluded was, in fact, in the galaxy, there is a cutoff, and there is a maximum. But on the case when in galaxy, there are some galaxies where there's no maximum, then you would, you know, your best guess would be that you would continue to experiment.
Well, I guess my feeling is that I don't think we know. I don't think we have anywhere near the sampled region to say really what is out there. And I think it's because there have been lots of infrared surveys. You know, TUMAS has been around for a long time. So, well, you know, surely we would have found them. And, you know, it's true.
Well, TUMAS is a shallow survey.
It's shallow.
Like web surveys.
Yeah.
Shallow survey.
And it, remember, too, Westland 1 is really a remarkable cluster. It is impressive. It has an AV of 10. That's nothing to an infrared astronomer. I mean, it was discovered in the optical, after all, right? So we actually have one sort of in our neighborhood. It's actually in a hole of extinction. Around it, the extinction is much higher. So it just sort of happened to be, the curtain has been drawn a bit, and wow, there it is.
How does Westland 1 compare with 3603?
Oh, it's almost 100 times the mass. Yeah. Well, almost 100.
3603 is much more than 1,000.
Oh, yeah. It's almost 100. It's probably 50 times. But I think 3603 is 7 times 10 to the third.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, and this is under 10 to the 5. So, you're right. It's not quite. But it's less than R136. All right. So, my feeling, though, is it's a little bit early, right, to be making these kind of statements, I think. There's a selection effect, too, which no one has really looked at. When you do a survey in the infrared, people say, okay, you know, now the extinction is gone, we can just see them all, like we did in the optical. But I don't think that's quite right. I think that working in the infrared, things look a little different. Okay, it's not unusual. You know, you use different lines. You use infrared lines to look at certain types of energies than you do look at UV lines. I mean, when you look at different wavelengths, you see kind of different things going on. And that's something I think is not fully appreciated. Okay? So it turns out that probably because I couldn't get time. I got totally clouded out last summer. And then I didn't get time this past year to do more of these clusters. And also, I started seeing papers. A lot of people are doing this cluster work. It's really coming along. You know, Spitzer's discovering a lot of things. People are doing follow-up stuff. And I've done enough of these to go, you know, it's kind of boring work anyways. You know, the method's all known, right? You just go take images, and then you go back in infrared spectra. And I actually decided I really wasn't so interested maybe in just getting in this race of characterizing hundreds of clusters. And then what does it tell you? Unless you know your selection effects, you can't say what you've found and what the significance of that is. Right? You just don't know. If all you're finding is clusters with the most massive star is an O9 star, what does that mean? Does that mean there's a mass function that dies? So, because I had a year to waste on this, I set my graduate student on the task of developing a simulation of a cluster. Okay? These are kind of earlier ones. These were probably done earlier this summer. So they're not the best. It keeps rabbing through. What you've seen here is a first guess simulation of Westland 1. This is a simulation of a cluster of stars formed all at the same time, with a mass of 10 to the 5th solar masses, extinction of 11. It's put more or less at the distance or whatever, everything's corrected for that. And it's cycling through it doesn't do exactly the birth, we just ignore that, stars just form on a particular Tuesday. and then you just watch them evolve. Now the code actually is pretty intense. It actually follows the evolutionary track of 10, maybe 10,000 stars, and all the photometric bands using the Geneva Code. So at any time, you can plot up what at this age, you know, at say 10 million years, at 20 million years, 100 million years, what would UV minus V minus V plot look like? What would a V image look like? What would a B image look like? You can make anything you want. The data is all there. Okay. So what you see, first of all, which is not a big thing, it's just started again here. The B is very dim. I probably should have had him do it all the same color. I think he was just trying to show the different colors. And it's because of the extinction. And the V is kind of dim too. Here's the J, which stars are a little bit brighter. So you do see by the time you get to AV of 10, you're right on the border of whether or not you want to work in the optical or the J. They're pretty close because, of course, stars are blue, they're relatively blue, right? And the V minus J is a magnitude at least for B star. So. But what is not fully appreciated is, look, you can see it more in the V. When the stars first form, I'll show you again, and I'll show you another simulation too, which is a little slower. When the stars, now we're getting 10 to the 8th, whatever, when they first form, here, the most brightest stars are the most massive, and usually that's the case. And right here, they're starting to go supernova, and then here they're going to have red supergiants. You get this phase at about 10, starting about, well, 6 or 7 million years, where the most luminous red supergiants first form. And then as it evolves, you continue to make red supergiants, although not quite as luminous as the first ones that came out, right? And what's not appreciated, I think, by people used to working in the UBV is the differential between the brightness of those, particularly those first red supergiants, compared to the rest of the main sequence. It's like 10 magnitudes different. Okay? And like, for instance, when I was putting together a project with Phil Massey, we were going to do some work on Westland 1, and we were doing it in J, and I said, well, you got to be very careful because the red supergiants are really, really bright. You know, he goes, oh, yeah, no, I know. We do UBV all the time. I go, no, they're really, really bright. And you're going to overexpose well before you'll ever get to the rest of the main sequence. You need enormous dynamic range to see both the red supergiants at the same time as the main sequence when you're way out here. Okay, here's starting again. And there's the red supergiants. And they become more numerous and a little bit more less luminous with time as they go. Okay? So it turns out that the near-infrared is actually required, obviously, when you get extinction because you can't see anything, but the searchers are going to be very sensitive to certain ages. Just like Westland 1 was found out only because it had those red supergiants, those 12 red supergiants come blasting through, even in the opticals of an eye that came back. Not really eye, but... So when we use the near-infrared...
Can you remind me what is the duration of the red supergiant phase?
Well, they don't live in that phase very long, but it expands over for a long period because it just keeps getting dimmer and dimmer. And then you get AGBs that are still pretty bright, but those are much lower mass.
Compared with a reasonable range of stellar ages, if it's really true that you have just one peak of an age, or if it's actually...
Yeah, they live 10 to the 4 years.
Oh, yeah, they don't live very long. I mean, they're...
But what I'm saying is spread...
Any single star. But you'll see red...
But it's naturally much larger, so it's not true that you would have such a spiky...
Right, right.
...evolution.
Yep. Yeah, you'll start to see them around 6 million years. 5 or 6 million years, you'll start to see the first red supergiants. And then they'll continue to see them. The most luminous and the most rarest, highest luminous ones will be first. And as you continue to see them for another maybe 20 or 30 million years or so, you'll see them. But they won't be quite as luminous, and there'll be more of them because they're coming from lower mass stars, which there's more of them to make red supergiants. And the lifetimes are slightly longer, but still more or less, you know, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 or something. Not very long, 10 to the 5.
Excuse me, Margaret, so you're saying this 5 or 6 million years, are you saying that then the most massive stars don't go through a red supergiant phase?
The very, very most massive ones with the Geneva models do not. And so what's interesting is when I show the other simulation, you will see a little bit. There's a couple of stars that will become very bright right away within 3 or 4 million years, and they never became red supergiants. They just became blue supergiants, will phrase, and then they're gone. They go supernova, and they're out of the system right away. The most luminous stars are when those red supergiants hit. The first red supergiant around 4 or 5 million years. It's really hard to do these simulations because you need such dynamic range. So the simulation I'll show you in a bit, the red supergiants come on, and it makes a halo. It's so bright compared to the rest of the stars. But you'd see that thing as a beacon, you know, through probably 50 magnitudes of extinction. But a single star, which one would you know was the one that was a red supergiant? It needed to be a cluster of red supergiants. Then you might say, oh, there's something interesting about that, which is why Westland 1 was first discovered. Okay, so the point is that let's start looking at what's coming out of these searches. And Don Figer has done a lot of work on massive clusters. Who knows who he is? He's moved from working on the inner region, and now is trying to find clusters in the plane of the galaxy. And he's found two very massive clusters. I don't think either one is as big as Westland 1. The second one, I don't have it here. It's hard to say, and I'll explain to you why it's hard to say. Because you need to know the age, as somebody was saying to Ed. If you don't know the age, you do not know the mass. But this is a cluster which was found with two mass. Those dozen stars there are very, very bright. So two mass found them. And it's like Westland 1. All you see is just the very top dozen stars. Okay? So this is a K versus J minus K diagram of that cluster. You've got your dozen stars or something up there. And then you have, okay, well, so these are the main sequence, right? Those are the K giants. Oh, so these are the main sequence, right? The main sequence down here. When these guys are gone, this cluster will be gone from sight. You'll have no way of finding it. It's so buried with all the K giants in the field. Extinction's 30.
Oh, they're all fizz stars, you mean? Everything apart from the four or five on top.
Yeah, the main sequence is way down there. Way, way down there. You're never going to see the main sequence on this, ever. And it's not even just about getting a bigger telescope, because there's so many stars. You've got to look through this, the number of stars you have to look through now, because you're going further and further. You're seeing every K giant, you know, in the galaxy along that sight line. And you can't use colors anymore to separate them out so well, because you're never going to get a J band on this. The AV is too high. And everything looks the same color when you get out to, you know, 3, 4, 5 microns. Everything looks the same color pretty much. It's going to be very hard to separate out where the main sequence on this is. So, yeah, you find it now, and it's easy. But it's obviously incredibly preferred to that age. And as soon as it's not in that age anymore, then you couldn't find it.
So the masses are based on stellar velocities? What are they based on?
They're based on evolutionary diagrams, which means you have to make an assumption of the age.
No, the total mass of the cluster.
Yeah.
What's the integration?
They say you need so many masses to support.
That plus some IMF.
Yeah, you would make it. Well, yeah, that's a reasonable assumption because IMF seems to be pretty universal. But the reason why this is heavily dependent, the mass you get is heavily dependent on the age. Age and mass are dependent, is they're correlated. Is if these are, say, came from 12 solar mass stars, and there's only, you know, 5 or 6, that's a much lower mass cluster than if these came from, say, 20 or 30 solar mass stars, and there's 12 or 13 of them. So statistically, and you have no way of knowing unless you have a way of figuring out what the intrinsic luminosity of this these guys are. And you don't know the distance to this thing. So until you know the distance to this, once you know the distance, then you're good. But how are you going to get the distance of this?
Well, they have the distance. How do they get it?
It's all put together. It all plays together. That's a consistent number. The mass, the age, and the distance are all consistent.
You mean they just made it up, though?
It's consistent.
Well, what if
it's one answer. If you want to choose, you could put this much closer, right? And then these guys would be near as luminous, which means they represent a lower mass in the mass function, which means the mass goes down. So that's all colored. They all go together.
But that would be a valid solution, you're saying. So
yep.
They really made it up. We should just cancel out that. Somebody just made up a number.
Pretty much. I don't see any evidence for why they...
No, but they must make an assumption for the metallicity, and then with the track, they can fit for the distance.
And metallicities are all the same.
So once you take off the metallicity from the equation, then you can fit in the 2D space for the...
Not in JHK, you can't.
Yeah, because you have the...
Oh, you can't tell. You can't tell.
Well, those bright enough to be able to get spectrum.
Yeah. So that's the way you do it.
You can get spectrum. Right?
Yeah. And you'd look at the depth of the CO band heads.
Oh, sure.
So could you use X-ray observations to move plus these young cluster memberships here, looking at a few million years, and then
yeah,
you see all the stars, far away?
That I don't know. You'd have to ask, you know, Eric Feigelman or something about that. But I don't know that would.
In principle, you could see the X-ray. I mean, the mean free path is about the same as mid infrared photon. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that the X-rays tend to pick out mainly low-mass stars with magnetic activity, atmospheric activity. And so the population is a separate population.
Yeah, but that's for all the masses. The 10 to 15 masses is all the
masses. Well, that's
right. And you establish a cluster. Yeah.
But I don't think you would see X-rays in AB of 30 at 5 kiloparsecs.
That'd be tough.
I was talking to Eric last week about this, and he just said, going out to 2 kiloparsecs at an AV above 15 is starting to make it impossible to see these low mass populations.
Wow.
So for that, you know, you can also...
Well, but Sonia claimed that there's an anomalous IMF in the galactic center, which is 30 magnitudes also, because there are no low mass stars seen it with Chandra. So he somehow thought that he could see it. He should have seen it, but didn't. And so he said that the IMF is anomalous. You're saying maybe Eric is saying he wouldn't be able to see it. Well, maybe, of course, they may have just spent more time.
That's true.
Yeah.
They do have spectra of these red supergiants, so it's possible that they think they know the luminosity from those spectra. They have Keck spectra, which are pretty good. So maybe it's stronger than I maybe suggested, but
so
it's definitely all dependent.
You could point Chandra there and conclude.
Say again?
You could point Chandra there and say.
Well, yeah, but I don't think you'd get the time, because no one would believe you'd detect anything. Okay. So what I was going to say, though, is just the bottom line is the kind of stuff we're going to find is going to be very dependent on the evolutionary stage, right? There's going to be these huge biases. Okay, so what we're going to do now, we're almost done. what we're trying to do is see if we can figure out where the selection effects are high, where they're low, you know, and try and see if we can correct for that for what's coming in. Obviously, this has to be, you have to still do sort of a survey of some sort, but this is more recent simulations that have been done. They're getting a little better now. We used 3603, a very well-known cluster, because Andrea Stolde just did her thesis on it, and so she had just outstanding data on what the characteristics of this cluster was. And so we started using that as one of the clusters we're going to do. We've also added a star field, just following some kind of pattern of what you typically see for the magnitude range. So what we do in this simulation is we give it the mass, we give it the extinction, give it the distance, and then we just let it run. Oh, I know. We also do it's a King distribution for the stars in the spatial way, because obviously the IMF doesn't tell you where to put them. And we give it a core radius and a tidal radius. And that's why Andrea actually measured that for 3603. Okay, so here's our simulated cluster, and there's her cluster. That's the real cluster, and both in simulated J-band. Now, the difference, of course, is that we don't do nebulosity. So that's one thing that's obviously not there. But that's not really what we're so much interested in. The question is, as with nebulosity will be lost within a few million years, very quickly. And the question is, for how long will this cluster be detectable at its current distance, its current extinction, things like that, right? It turns out this one, because extinction is not really very high, will probably be would have been detectable at any age nearly, because the extinction is low enough. You can actually kind of use the blue. So let me show that next, which is this simulation of NG3603. And what you're going to see, though, is first of all, the cluster has a completely artificial collapse to it. So very slowly, the stars are kind of pulling together. That actually was in the Westland one as well. I'm not sure how realistic that is, but so you'll start to see some of the outer, there's a few stars out here that actually are part of the cluster, and they'll start to fall in. And within about 4 million years, you'll start to see some of the guys starting to go through the blue, like red blue supergiant phase and Wolf-Rayet stage. And then around 6 or 7 million years, all of a sudden the red supergiants, and they're just hugely bright, because these represent the most massive stars that go to red supergiants. Okay, so here's the movie. So this is when it was at 1 million years old already. For instance, these little guys are all moving inside. This guy over here is moving in. There's a couple of theories you see moving in. And this is the true age. This is the age since the observations. So there's the first guy going already at 2.75. He's gone. That was a blue supergiant. And now you can start seeing this popcorn effect of blue supergiants, and then the red supergiants start. There's actually, I think, even more luminous ones. Yeah, those are basically red supergiants. Now, this is not as massive a cluster as Westland 1, and so even when it goes through the red supergiant phase, there's only a few. This is 10 times less massive, or maybe a few times 10 less massive than Westland 1, so it's never going to have a dozen red supergiants at one time until it gets much later in its evolution when it's like 20 million years old. They're all kind of crunching. What makes it hard is like, there's a red supergiant there. And that one finally went. That was the guy that was coming in from out here. So that was probably like an early B star. And now you're getting many more stars that are doing that very luminous thing. They're not as luminous as the first red supergiants that came out. So if you don't know the distance of this thing, if you don't get the luminosity right, you can get the mass totally different. If you think those are all the super luminous ones, you'd say it was a very massive star.
I don't understand. Why are there so many points that never move over millions of years?
Oh, because that's the one thing is this is a star field.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, so we try to put it into a field. So this is why our simulations have to have a sky, because when we're going to come through and see, would a search find this?
Yeah,
you know, this is easy. Yeah, I'm sorry, I should explain that. So it's starting again. So it's kind of fun to look for this. I think it's, which is the guy here? It's this one here. He comes in, and they see him go off about here.
So on what time scale can you do proper motion in these objects? With current... imaging.
Oh, gee, I don't know. They're doing proper motions in the Galactic Center, right?
Look at the stars moving there.
Yeah. Well, they do proper motions of the, at this distance, I think.
So that'd be useful to estimate masses, right?
Well, for this, I'm not sure if it's this is entirely a fake toy fall in, right? We're just...
No, I don't mean the toy, but the proper motions.
To get masses of these stars? Yeah, maybe, after a while. Or you could maybe just use their radial velocities.
No, I mean to map the potential. I mean,
Yeah. They definitely do that for observable clusters. Anyways, okay, so that's what we're trying to do. The point was, first we're going to simulate all the sort of main known guys in the galaxy to make sure that when we are clusters of the supposed mass and age and this extinction and distance, that it looks pretty much the same, and that's how we're going to calibrate a whole bunch of our stuff. And then the question becomes, okay, now let's take 100 of these and plunk them in basically a model for the galaxy, and then see how many of these would we pick out as a function of age. Assume they survive forever. Straw man hypothesis. Assume they survive forever and just sort of see, at what point do you stop seeing them? Because not because they die or get dispersed, but because they just aren't being picked up by current surveys. And that starts to give you a handle on where the biases are in these infrared surveys now. Okay. So I have some more proposals. I just sent one in yesterday to SOAR to continue doing infrared observations for these clusters to characterize them. But in fact, now I think... more important of the work that I'm trying to do, because a lot of people are doing the clusters, that's not going to be a significant contribution to do more, is to try and figure out what the biases are and the current search methods and how we might be able to say something about what numbers are out there and that what fraction are we possibly missing. It's very complicated. It's a very difficult question to answer, and I really couldn't think of any other way to answer without actually going to these Monte Carlo simulations to basically simulate the galaxy, the plane of the galaxy, and start looking and see what search engines Willoughby would find on these things. Okay. Now, finally, I think too, which I don't usually bring up much, but if we start characterizing, that's one of the reasons we're getting spectra of hundreds of B supergiants in Westland 1, is this is actually going to be useful. The extragalactic people are not going to recognize this quite right away, but if we can see analogs of superstar clusters locally where we can study the stellar content of them, and then assuming that the star formation is the same, that everything's the same, that will actually help them in their simulations, because all they get is a point of light, right? When they do an image, they get a spectrum, and they don't even get a spectrum hardly. They get a spectrum maybe, but they just get a point of light, and they have to use the integrated colors and things to try and figure out what the mass function is. And so it would be nice to know that, you know, we can actually help them in those sort of endeavors by saying, okay, here's a local analog where we can actually see the stellar content and look at the IMF and things like that. Okay, that's all I had.
I'm just thinking about some of the observational issues that can occur in this kind of business. And young clusters are usually still associated with a lot of gas and dust, therefore extinction. And a couple of years ago, I had an REU student, and I thought we would look at some of these infrared dark clouds and simply see if we could image them or map them out by looking at the red supergiants through those clouds. And so what I was expecting was to see much redder objects. In fact, what we saw was much bluer objects. And I thought, what's going on here? Well, what's going on is that the clouds were so awfully thick that all you're seeing are the foreground stars, which are not red,
right?
Blue.
Yeah.
So you can be fooled by a lot of these kinds of
selections. Well, that's what's nice about Orion, right? That's what makes Orion so easy to work with, because there's a big molecular cloud, and it just blocks the rest of the stuff behind. Also, it's above the plane, you know. But when you're looking in the plane, you're just seeing all these stars. It's really difficult.
So there is another way, of course, to try to get at the clusters, and that's with radio surveys. So that's what John Williams and I did. And so we.
But those only are the clusters that are just formed, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a very small, short time scale.
Exactly. And so that's exactly correct. So what we did.
But you can correct for that.
Is
yeah.
To calculate what the rate of formation then of the clusters is, and then assuming that the star formation of the galaxy is more or less constant, we
yeah.
then calculate how many clusters you would expect. And in fact, we even then predict how many. So it'd be interesting to know is the infrared data in FOOS, because we predicted what the surface density of those clusters is.
So in the infrared, because of the radio, or
well, no, just well because we count. We assume that we have all the clusters. I should say, because these were from H2 regions, but these were only the largest ones. We normalize using giant and supergiant H2 regions, and for normalization. And the Orion cluster is 1/4 of the giant H2 region, so it's nothing.
Yeah.
So we did that, and then we took, as you showed in your results, that you had this 1/L² distribution. So we, based on Kennicott's work, we assumed that also.
Mm-hmm.
We then extrapolated, as theorists, only theorists could do, all the way from these giant H2 regions down to a single V star. And so then basically then, we have it as a function of position in the galaxy, or we averaged over spark hours. And it works out fairly well. And then it turned out that if you go ahead and use that model for the stars and you calculate what is the ultraviolet background measured at the Earth, which is now dominated by much older stars, more like 20 million years old, and it turns out to be with observation.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
So. Do you see upper mass cutoff? It's not like you did.
That's right. So it was not,
just
I don't
at least
remember the number that we got off the top of my head. But we did. When we looked at Kennicott's data, we saw that some of his galaxies seem to have a cutoff and some didn't.
Right.
And so those that have a cutoff, then we said, well, presumably there's some physical mechanism, such as a subfraction of the maximum molecular cloud mass.
Yeah.
And particularly, it seemed to be more like with the irregular galaxies or the smaller galaxies that there was no.
But did you get this 10 to the 5?
But I don't remember is the we didn't convert to masses. I can go back and do that after. But there are some pretty big ones.
Because those are the young ones.
Those would be a lower limit anyway, I suspect. Because otherwise you've got to assume from the radio, you've got to assume that a substantial fraction of the photons are absorbed by the ambient medium. In many cases, some of it escapes or is converted to infrared by dust.
That's right. And so the way we corrected for that, because that was an important correction. We then used the COBE data to actually, and also then radio surveys the whole galaxy. So you know what the total ionizing output of the clusters is. But when we went ahead and integrated based on the observations, we only got 1/3 of that. So we said that, in fact, each of the clusters was 3 times larger than we.
Now, Margaret, if you look at a large O star cluster, you find that the early B stars continue to form for about 10 million years, longer after the O stars have formed. And so you really have a much wider distribution, at least of the early B stars and the late O's.
Yeah, in some cluster, that's true. I do. That's right. And in this one, in 3603, it's not. Because she goes all the way down to the pre-main sequence turn off, and she sees a complete IMF all the way down.
But so for that, will have an impact in terms of how
simulating.
How long?
Yeah.
Well, in terms of how long you can recognize the cluster.
Yeah.
Right, because what, these early B stars form over 10 million years longer.
It smears it out. Yeah.
It does.
So it can have a much higher mass and not be seen. I would guess because it'd be less.
Right.
Yeah.
And you'll mistakenly, characterize the mass because you'll think that they all formed.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between these two kinds of clusters? I mean, because as you say, 3603 formed fairly quickly. In the case of Orion, at least the O stars probably formed very all around the same time. And I don't think there's any more B star formation going on right in at least in the Orion nebula cluster itself.
Right.
Well,
so
where it's just behind there. Mm-hmm. It's not
It's a separate cluster, though. That would be seen as a separate cluster, though, because by the time it comes out, Orion and I will be more evolved, and it would be seen, I think, as a separate, dynamically separate cluster.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil Massey always would say that whenever we did these analyses of massive clusters, he would always see a few stars that had gone off early, and then all of a sudden they all sort of go off at once. And he used to, the popcorn reference I made is sort of from him. He would say it's like, you know, when you pop popcorn, a few go, and all of a sudden, brrr, they all go. But he never saw a lot of evidence, I don't think, and I could be wrong, that it was spread over quite that much. It may be that you're seeing, you know, along a chain of star formation, and they're not dynamically together, I'm not sure. But most of them tend to be fairly coeval.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of gas left over from the initial host star formation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what we see in Sig OB, in the Cygnus OB Association,
yeah.
Sig OB2, is it?
Oh, there's so many clusters,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, VR21 and
W7. Yeah, exactly.
That is, you see this O star cluster, a very clear cluster, and now there's these B stars forming,
yep,
all around it.
Yeah.
B stars are forming, and they're something like 10 million years old now.
Yeah.
Relative to, you know, the O star population. So that could be where you're getting your age distribution.
Well, Cygnus is about the most sloppiest region to try to work. It's just terrible. It's just Sig OB 1 through 9, and, you know, and they were just, you know, basically Roberta Humphrey said, okay, there's a cluster and here's a cluster. Well, she's not God. That doesn't make it a dynamic cluster. So many of those are not even real clusters and not true associations. And that's one of the things I found about Sig OB 2. Indeed, I found a whole bunch of stars, but a lot of them weren't interlopers. And they weren't really part of Sig OB 2. You know, we're still seeing some more Sig OB 2 there, but it's just the whole thing. I think we're kind of looking down that spiral arm there, and they're just all lined up on top of each other. It's really complicated.
I think one of the challenges of the theoreticians is to try to understand how in the heck you can make a 10 to the 6 solar mass cluster without it breaking up into little clumps like W49 has.
Right.
We can see that kind of structure and probably understand it in reasonable, you know, reasonable.
What is the scale in which W49 is broken up at?
It's about 50 parsecs.
It's big.
Yeah, it's very large regions, but the sort of things that you're talking about in Westmoreland 1 is a much more compact thing, and somehow you've been able to gather all of this mass into a fairly small volume, form a single massive cluster.
Yeah.
And it's the same problem.
But it's going to go up to be an association. It's going to be an OB association. It's not going to be a single cluster, right? It's going to, you know.
Well, you work on that.
You are probably bringing lots of regions together to form these massive places. All be quickly, so you have to have a big reservoir of gas that you're working from.
Right, you have to have a huge reservoir of gas.
But it's not.
I mean, our experience.
And I think these are processes you're seeing even in the formation of Orion, where you may be bringing, you know, subregions together fairly quickly to build this bigger.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think our experience from the radio observations of giant molecular clouds is that these things are pretty diffuse. They're not compact.
Right.
So you have to somehow figure out a way to bring all of that gas into a fairly small volume.
But I worry about the time scale for that. People are always looking for, well, we don't see a 10 to the 7 that has that kind of density. I said, well, what's the chance it's going to survive more than 10 to the 4 years? You know, I mean, that something like that is so beyond ready to fall apart. I mean, I just think that finding those is going to be hard.
The theoretical limit here is pretty easy. It's been long known. Like, you're building these clouds by agglomeration, so there's this time scale to build larger structures. And if nothing happens to that cloud, i.e. blow the pieces, the mass peak of the cloud just keeps going up and up and up and up in mass because nothing can happen to it. So what can prevent that is a scale where star formation destroys the clouds faster than you could bring in more gas. But we sort of know that star formation chips away at clouds, right? It sort of
keeps it
pieces
from
off. It doesn't destroy the whole cloud particularly.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to prevent the galaxy to take, I mean, to be slightly absurd, but if you've got enough converging flow at some resonance in the galaxy, you've got 10 of the 9 solar masses of material to play with. You could probably build.
But you should see some evidence for this sort of thing in the transition in point.
Well, the massive
cluster.
You
see the clusters.
Yeah.
You don't see what happens in between.
That admittedly advised in this idea of some link between cluster mass and cloud mass, which needs to be tied down. But I think all the theory that anybody has worked on, Chris or ourselves or others, and it seems to indicate that there is that scaling.
Okay, I did want to make this, for the observer, saying that there is a theoretical disagreement here. If you get to the right section of Eve in my review, you'll see that we completely annihilate the theory that GMCs grow by annihilation.
By What is your?
So it's like gravitational instability. Is how they're.
But that'll still bring pieces of gas together.
But you don't have to wait because you're right. If you actually try to knock things together, it takes a long time.
But I think you do have to, however, attach this to what you actually see in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. What you see in the galaxy are GMCs with size scale of about 100 or so parsecs.
That's right. And I think also if you look at the regions where people have mapped out where high mass stars are forming, the radio astronomers like Neil Evans group, they find that there are several thousands of solar masses in size. Yeah. And so far I don't think there's been a region which is the size of a black hole cluster seen in our galaxy in gas.
I think it would be pretty obvious, but occasionally, that would be your extreme upper limit, of course, maybe 10 to the 7 solar masses.
My guess is that you should not see them 10 to the 7 solar mass clouds, because that would suggest that you're forming one all the time, and that's not what statistically you should be forming one all the time. You have something like 10 to 100 times more time in the massive star cluster form, time span than you do in the formation in the molecular cloud time span. So, if you saw one, that means there'd be 100 that have now gone on and now live in the galaxy, and that's not predicted. So, statistically, you shouldn't see them.
5 or 10 to 6, in my mind at least, poses
a real problem.
Yeah.
I agree.
Sure.
If we talk about the galactic plane, it's not just difficult to distinguish clusters, it's difficult to distinguish individual molecular clouds. So, how much do we know? What do we know about
where does the cloud edge start and begin?
The mass distribution of clouds in the galactic plane not too far from the center of that galaxy?
There's been a lot of data on that.
That you would know, I would trust. And is that a power law? Is that a power law?
There's a lot of confusion, clearly, right? Of course, the velocity helps, but...
Well, I think in the nature of astronomy, you rarely get hard answers to anything. In general, I think there's pretty good agreement from the radio astronomers. Maybe some other observers here want to contradict me here, but the radio, these CO surveys about your plane give you reasonably good constraints on the nature.
So the largest mass is 10 to the 6 or so?
Up to 10 to the 7th, but 10 to the 7th is unusual.
So the 20% efficiency which you need for a cluster at least, that you would form a 10 to the 5 solar mass cluster.
Well, yeah, that's the, I mean, I gave you the factor of 100, and so say 10 to the 7th solar masses you need in order to form a
10 to the 5.
But you don't form a cluster with 1% efficiency.
Well, that's about right. I thought it was 1%.
The point that Ed is making, that's 100 parsecs. Yeah, that's not a cluster. You have to make something that is gravitational.
Yeah, that's much smaller. That's the point. I'm not disputing the issue that there, that such clouds exist. There are a few of them that do. They're rare, but there are a few. It's the problem of assembling all that mass in a fairly small.
And what is the state of the art of the mass distribution of clouds? The slope, of the part, if it is a power law,
it is a power law.
The integrated one's minus 0.6.
So it's not minus one. So there will be a discrepancy between the distribution of clouds and the dot clusters as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But your point is interesting. Qualitatively, this is much different than the point we're struggling with in general, which is how did an Orion cloud, why are you forming stars in just this tiny little place?
It's the same thing forming a single star. Right. You start out with a cloud that's about 10 million times bigger.
So it's not a qualitatively different question than we're trying to answer anyway. Mm-hmm. But
on the theory part, you're right. But on the observational part, there is a real problem in the sense that observationally, there are none.
You don't see them.
Anyway, I think we should thank
Good.